Evidence and Answers begins right now. This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics. The defense of the Christian faith. Is beauty just in the eye of the beholder? Or is it something real and objective? For centuries, philosophers and theologians have wrestled with this question. Today on Evidence and Answers, Dr. Brian Nixon joins us to explain how beauty, truth, and goodness are connected, and how beauty provides a powerful argument for the existence of God. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this discussion entitled, He Made All Things Beautiful, and you'll find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now, let's get right into the conclusion of this interesting discussion.
You're exactly right. We're hardwired to appreciate and want beauty. I mean, it is a need. Like here, you just can't put up a building here in Hawaii or really anywhere in the United States, a gray building, and just put it up. It's got to be nice. And you got to spend thousands of dollars to beautify that building, or the city or the county is not going to let you put it up. I mean, you got to paint it. You got to make, you know, you just can't put any kind of cement on it or wood. I mean, it's got to be attractive. It's got to look good, or the neighbors will want to tear it down.
Yeah, sure.
So we're hardwired, just like you said.
Yeah, exactly. And Pat, why that's important, and this is something I think could serve our communities, but could also serve our church. Once we realize that God is beautiful, once we realize that humans desire and seek beauty, once we realize that our brain is hardwired for beauty, why don't we pay more attention to beauty in our environments? Now, I'm not saying let's have an unhealthy preoccupation, which a lot of our culture does, by the way. They elevate beauty over God or over other things. But we should value the beautiful alongside the true and the good, because people respond accordingly to beautiful. If you walk into a city that has not been thought out well, that has not been designed aesthetically pleasing, you don't want to stay there. But you will go to cities that are designed aesthetically pleasing, that have a uniqueness to them. And it becomes an attractive, delightful place to be. Much like you have in Hawaii, we have here in New Mexico, Santa Fe. Santa Fe has those same type of qualities that you just can't go and build some monstrosity building there. You really have to go by the codes of the city, because they understand there's an aesthetic appeal people expect in places like that. So we could learn a lot by how our brains perceive beauty and why we should highlight and even elevate beauty when we're constructing things.
Yeah, now some will argue here, Brian, and say, well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's a subjective thing. Everyone defines beauty differently, but is beauty objective or is it subjective or a little bit of both?
Yeah, this is the million-dollar question. I talked to people, I've read people and go, oh, beauty's just subjective. What's beautiful for you is not beautiful for me. It's all in the eye of the beholder, as you said. Well, there's truth to that, but then there's non-truth to that. Beauty, if we understand it properly, involves both dimensions. Objectively, beauty exists, and subjectively, individuals perceive and interpret existence differently. So the way I like to say it in layman's term is to think of this as a two-story building. The first floor, that foundational level, is what we would call ontology. And ontology is the study and recognition of being, why something exists, that there is existence. So beauty exists simply because something exists. Ontologically, that study of being asks the question, what it is. So at this level, beauty is subjective. It is. It exists. It's connected to being. So if something exists, it has a level of beauty. But then that second, that upper floor, is what I would call the teleology. So it's not just so much that something exists, but everything has form. It has shape. It has function. And that is what we would call teleology. So teleology is the form, the function, the shape, and the intended results of an object. So the teleology, if you will, is the subjective part. And I'm just going to use something just kind of off the top of my head here, Pat. I'll use an apple. An apple, ontologically, is beautiful. It exists. It represents something that God created. Mm-hmm. We could agree upon that. Two people could say an apple exists. So we would have to say, ontologically, that apple has existence. Therefore, it has a semblance of beauty. But then the second layer is you may have had a bad experience with an apple. Let's say as a kid, you bit into an apple and there was a worm in that apple. And you would go, oh, I've just had a terrible experience with apples. So every time I see an apple, I get the eebie-jeebies. I think of biting into that. And I think of that worm. And so I have had a really terrible example with apple. Therefore, teleologically, I don't like it. It gives me the creeps. Well, that is where the subjective idea comes into it. Objectively, we both recognize it exists. It has being. Therefore, it has beauty. But teleologically, you have bad associations with it. Therefore, you don't like it. Whereas, let's say maybe me, I go, oh boy, Pat, I love apples. All the thoughts I have of apples are my grandmother giving me one for a snack, and she always was looking out for me. And I absolutely love apples. So that's where the subjective nature comes in. You don't like apples because you had a bad experience with them, or you don't like how they look or taste or feel. Whereas I've had a really positive experience with them. Therefore, I like them. So that's the subjective. But we can't deny the more deeper level of the objective, the fact that it exists. So, in other words, something may possess beauty objectively, yet a person may feel to perceive it or appreciate it. So from an ontological perspective, all created things possess beauty because they participate in being. And as I already said, God doesn't make junk. But how we perceive or appreciate that being is the subjective notion.
Yeah, so Brian, summarize it for us. How does beauty argue for the existence of God? And also, why is it such a powerful argument for God's existence that transcends really all cultures?
Yeah. Well, in my book, before Dr. Geisler died, I'm so pleased, I gave an argument for beauty. And my argument I position is a syllogism. And I sent it to Dr. Geisler. And he said, you know, upon first glance, this is really strong. And so here's my argument. If beauty exists, it must be conjoined to a necessary being, which cannot not exist. So if beauty exists, it's connected to a greater being, what we would call God. Number two, consequently, beauty as an attribute of a necessary being cannot not exist. It is actual. So we know beauty is actual. It exists. Number three, beauty exists. Therefore, we must conceive of beauty as real, rooted in reality, as an attribute of a necessary being, as conveyed through creation. Beauty is, therefore God exists. So that's kind of the fancy syllogism of it. But what it is in a nutshell is because beauty is, there must be a beautiful one. The fact that we could talk and discuss about something that exists must position that there exists something greater than that. It goes back to the simple question, the ontological argument, which this argument is intimately connected to the ontological argument. And that asks, why is there something rather than nothing? So there's something because there's someone or something that we would call God. So let's put that to beauty. Beauty exists. Therefore, something beautiful must exist. And we call that something or someone God. And to answer your second part, why we're so attracted to beauty is, I think it goes back to a gentleman who I think articulated this very well. He's a philosopher and theologian. His name's David Bentley Hart. And he laid it out at least in his first little principles, I think really eloquently. The fact that beauty is objective, the fact that it exists, it's real. We all recognize that there is something as beautiful. And that objectivity forms an idea of distance, that that object is not me and I'm not that object. And therefore, it brings up this idea of delight. It invites us to look at that object and go, boy, that's different for me. I'm delighting in it. And that then awakens desire. So what you pointed out a little bit early, why we are attracted to beauty is because it awakens desire. It awakens something in us that responds to that area, which is hardwired in our brain to want to either grasp it or to understand it. And it elicits this desire or this wonder. And so it is objectively real, but it awakens something in us that brings that delight and that desire for us wanting more of it. So it really is a profound notion. And there's no wonder why people throughout history, be it Plato or Aristotle or Plotinus or Thomas Aquinas or any contemporary thinker, deals with beauty on these level, because it truly is, again, one of those transcendentals, one of those areas that it's taken thousands upon thousands of years for people to explore and wonder at.
Yeah, Brian, I think we can give some examples of the power of this argument and how it just transcends culture. I just met with a group of men in Maui on the, you know, it's called the Japan Summit, movie producers, artists, businessmen, educators. And we all came together to figure out innovative ways to bring the gospel to Japan because, hey, you know, it's been tough. What, 1% of that population are evangelical believers in Christ. And so people have been trying out how to present the gospel in a way that people in that culture will receive it, you know. And one of the most successful is Black Gospel. You know, when the movie Sister Act came out, it was a hit in Japan. And all these people want to learn how to sing Black Gospel.
Yeah.
And so my friend there, Ken Taylor, he's a missionary, but also a musician. And this just caught him completely off guard. Thousands of these Japanese were paying him money to teach Black Gospel. And so he's got thousands of people, choirs that toured Japan and around the world of non-Christian Japanese singing Black Gospel.
Yeah.
And their response is, I love singing these things. There's something that just brings joy,
That's
you know,
right.
Especially after a hard day. You know, you explain that a little. Why is that so powerful and why are people responding like that?
Well, because again, it goes back to this sense of delight, a sense of desire, a sense of connecting with something that transcends a culture. Again, why something, let's say, uniquely American could appeal to, let's say, a Japanese culture is because beauty, be it music or art or any kind of aesthetic resonance, transcends that culture. And their brain, being hardwired for beauty, resonates with that. They delight in it. They desire it. And therefore, they participate in it. They participate in beauty. And it really makes sense to me because, as we said earlier in the broadcast, the Japanese culture is very attuned aesthetically to the notion of beauty. And you could even go back to the beautiful notion of the tea ceremony. The tea ceremony is one of the most beautiful elements you could go through in Japanese culture, and it holds almost a sacred value. And when you understand that part of that tea ceremony actually has Christian connotations or influenced by Christian thought, it really makes it unique. And then you get into the Japanese other forms of beauty, be it sumi-e, where they're using ink and paper and all these other facets. So Japanese have a heightened sense of, you know, an awareness of beauty. So when something beautiful comes along, their aesthetical sense resonates in it. They take delight in it, and therefore they desire it. And that is all part of the transcendental allure, the pull of beauty that cuts across every continent, every people group. I know I find the same in Japanese culture. There's things in Japanese culture I go, oh, I want to learn more about that. In Chinese culture, in African culture, in English culture, Russian culture, every culture has a unique confluence of beauty whereby when they share it with the rest of the world, we respond to it because we recognize beauty.
Yeah, I mean, here's another one that you and I talked about, C.S. Lewis, you know, in the Chronicles of Narnia. I mean, that's still a best-selling book throughout the world. You know,
yeah.
I know I run into people who've picked up a Korean translation, a Japanese translation, a Spanish translation of C.S. Lewis, and they just absolutely love it. And I explain to them, do you know that that's what C.S. Lewis was writing there is really about the gospel message of Christ? And they're like, what? Really?
Yeah.
And I start connecting the dots for them and they go, oh,
yeah.
But you see how something like that, a beautiful work of art through literature, just connected with people so that when the gospel came, they could connect the dots right away.
Very much so. Let me share something about C.S. Lewis here in a minute, but let me just say C.S. Lewis broadly would represent what I would call a classical theopoetic mindset, that he's using beauty and the arts to highlight and promote theological truths. And when I say theopoetics, understand that there are various schools of thought. There's a progressive side of theopoetics, and then there's a classical. I think C.S. Lewis would fall squarely within the classical use of it. But let me share something about C.S. Lewis that caught me by surprise. You'd mentioned my earlier doctoral studies, not my D ministry study at Veritas, but in with St. Equin's House and Minnesota School of Graduate School of Theology, I had to take a C.S. Lewis class. And during that class, I read that C.S. Lewis in his early life, early Christian life, was heavily on the apologetic side. He was trying to give a reasonable defense of the faith. And he was defending it, you know, with miracles and suffering and grief. And all of these things were being written in his early Christian life because he thought you had to give a rigorous mental defense of the Christian faith. Well, so this one teacher explored, he said, but what was interesting, what transformed C.S. Lewis is he got in a debate with actually a Roman Catholic woman who C.S. Lewis admitted won the debate. She won the debate. And he realized that always the academic pursuit of truth will fall short. So he, after that point, didn't write as many apologetic works. He instead turned his attention to beauty. He spent a good portion of his time exploring how you could communicate these Christian truths in a way that would appeal to people and make them more digestible. So you mentioned the Chronicles of Narnia. You mentioned his scientific areas, all or his science fiction writings, you know, Until We Have Faces. And all some of these are very complex books, such as Until We Have Faces, but they're exploring how beauty and truth could align, but using beauty to lead. Just as I said, Hans Urs von Balthasar did as well in his systematic theology. So you see a shift with C.S. Lewis, where initially it was all apologetics, but then in the latter part of his life, he really turned more or less to beauty, what I would call classical theopoetics. He was using the arts to present Christian truth.
Yeah, and the argument from beauty for this existence of God, I found to be much more, what shall we say, gentle in its approach. When I present the cosmological or teleological, people kind of like, well, that could just be this or that. But when you talk about beauty and say, you find that beautiful, where does that come from? Why is that beautiful?
Yeah.
That kind of generates a discussion. It seems to be a much more gentle approach and really effective if you understand the argument from beauty.
Yeah, unquestionably. What's interesting, and I'm just going to throw this out as kind of a little side notion, is I was watching a concert by a non-Christian online. His name is David Sylvian. And David Sylvian, I think he's an Englishman, but he's always associated himself maybe more along the lines of with Buddhist thought and ideals, and maybe even a little bit of Hindu. But there he is giving a concert, I believe it was in 2004, in Japan. He's a Westerner in Japan doing very complex music, but he had a Japanese videographer putting up videos on there. And there's this complex music mixed with a visual assimilation, transculturally, people coming from different ideologies and different perspectives, but they all converged upon this moment of beauty. And that resonated with everyone in that room. At least it did with me. I bet you if someone else watched it, they go, oh, I can't stand this music. I don't know what's going on. I don't like any of this. But again, that's the objective, subjective nature of it. But what I'm trying to say is that beauty transcends a culture. And the fact that it's wired in our brain, the frontal cortex, really communicates that not only is the objective reality of beauty there and people participate it, they desire it, they delight in it, but the fact that it's wired ontologically in our brain, it connotes an assortment of, it goes back to the beautiful one. There, someone must have designed our brain to appropriate and appreciate beauty.
Yes, that was a lot to take in. I'm sure for some people, this may be the first time they're hearing about how beauty points to a beautiful creator and how beauty really is a powerful argument for the existence of God. But if people, you know, you just got a taste of this argument here, and it's a fantastic one. As we speak, Brian and I are putting together a work on beauty and how it argues for the existence of God. But Brian, if people want more information on you and the argument from beauty, but also the other things that you've worked on, where can they go to get more information?
Well, the best place to go for more information is with the publisher, Cascade Publishing, or also the parent companies, Whiff and Stock. And they have my two beauties in what I would call the classical theopoetic realm. So Beauty and the Banana is with Whiff and Stock. And my other book, Tilt, Finding Christ in Culture, is also with Cascade, Whiff and Stock. So if they want more information, I would say go to the Whiff and Stock publisher's website. They're out of Oregon, and you could order the books there. But of course, there are other outlets you could find the book as well. Just go online. I personally don't have a website, but I do have a Facebook. You could go to Brian Charles Nixon Facebook. My musical groups are Abstain from Fastening a Brain, Low to Ground, and The Beautiful Gallows. So I do different musical projects as expressions of my theopoetic outlet and output. Abstain from Fastening a Brain is on Bandcamp, and that is more experimental chamber pop. The Low to Ground is more Americana genre. And then The Beautiful Gallows is more what I would call mainstream rock and roll, if you will. And I work with different people for each of those projects. So again, Abstain from Fastening a Brain, The Beautiful Gallows, and Low to Ground. All of those you could find online. If you want my poetry, I publish for the most part with Penwood Review. You could get their journals through Penwood Review as well. But again, the best way to get hold of me would be just through my Facebook page or go to one of those Bandcamp sites and email me from them.
Yes, you've been listening to our interview with Dr. Brian Nixon. He's professor of classical education and pastoral studies at Veritas International University. You can also go to the Veritas website and gain information on him and a whole host of great courses and professors at one of the top apologetics centers here in the United States. So, Brian, thanks for being with us here on Evidence and Answers.
Pat, it was great being with you. What an invigorating conversation. Thank you.
Our time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ. and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586. Or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio free to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.